Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, an accident I-17 southbound at Buckeye that has the left lane blocked. Also on I-10 eastbound, the HOV lane is blocked at Baseline. Sunny skies in the Valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 112. That would match yesterday's high. Clear skies tonight. Slight chance of rain. Overnight lows right around 90. Slight chance of rain again tomorrow with a high of 113. It's 108 degrees at KJZZ. As we continue to learn more about Zika virus, concern about the health of pregnant women and their unborn babies is growing. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports.
When it comes to Zika and how serious it really is, it depends on who you're looking at. For the general population, Zika can be a relatively mild illness. But among pregnant women, Zika can be devastating.
The most vulnerable period is the first trimester. However, you're not home free once you get past the first trimester, because we've seen issues that have arisen when women have been infected in the second and even some into the third trimester.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's with the National Institutes of Health. Fauci says those late-term issues can include blindness, deafness, or developmental impairments. He says microcephaly is just one of many manifestations, and it likely receives the most attention because it's the most obvious. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Democratic National Convention is in its fourth and final day in Philadelphia. Tonight, presidential nominee Hillary Clinton will give her acceptance speech and tell attendees, viewers, and listeners why she's a better choice than Donald Trump. The convention got off to a bumpy start on Monday, but spirits were high last night after speeches by President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. Peter O'Dowd of NPR's Here and Now has been in Philadelphia covering the convention and joins me. Peter, earlier today you spoke with a number of female supporters of Hillary Clinton. How enthusiastic are they, and is there any danger of the Clinton campaign taking female voters for granted?
Women here who are her staunch supporters feel like this is a very exciting, celebratory type of day. And I met young women, old women, all sort of noting that this wasn't possible 4 years ago, it wasn't possible 10 years ago. The country has moved forward in a way that they are happy to see. Now, on the other hand, Hillary Clinton does not have the woman vote wrapped up, which is kind of surprising to hear, actually. She does very well with millennials. She does very well with older women. But there's a Wall Street Journal poll out that shows just about 34% of women who are in their middle ages support Hillary Clinton. And that's a very important demographic. Some of these women may have problems with Hillary Clinton's economic policies. They may not trust her because of the email scandal that only got more interesting this week at the convention. But a lot of them also remember the 1990s and the sex scandal with Bill Clinton and the way that Hillary Clinton treated the women who were involved with her husband. You know, many people say that she was very cruel to people like Monica Lewinsky, and some women still remember that all these years later.
Tonight's going to be the biggest speech of her life. As you mentioned, people are ready to celebrate. They're ready to be enthusiastic about this. Any thoughts from any folks you talk to, or even just the vibe you're getting, that she's following her husband, who is one of the great political speakers of all time? She followed President Obama. Joe Biden gave an enthusiastic address last night as well. She has a lot to live up to. Does everyone think she's ready for it?
Yeah, isn't it interesting what happened on stage last night with President Obama? She came out and embraced the president after his speech. I mean, she's definitely making this case through her surrogates so far that a continuation of politics as we've seen them in Washington is actually going to be good for her. Now, that's also a dangerous bet to make, because this is an election that has been defined by outsiders. It's an election that's been defined by people like Donald Trump, who are agitating, who are taking advantage of an agitated population, who have reason to be concerned about the direction of the country. So she's making this bet that sticking with President Obama, acknowledging the fact that her husband, a former president, can help her along the way, she's really making a bet that that's going to pay off for her.
And Peter, finally, you're a Phoenix native. I've lived here most of my life, and there's a lot of talk that because primarily of Donald Trump and his anti-immigrant rhetoric, that this could be a state that flips to the Democrats. Have you had a chance to talk with anyone in the Arizona delegation or anyone at the political level to think, yeah, there are some states that if she comes out strong tonight in particular, she's going to have that momentum in some of those states that have usually gone against the Democrats?
Yeah, you know, Steve, you and I have been reporting in Arizona for a long time. There's been a lot of talk over the years that this is the year that will make the difference for the Latino vote in Arizona. You know, maybe it will be. Maybe Donald Trump will galvanize Latinos in a way that we haven't seen before. On the other hand, maybe Donald Trump will galvanize the white rural voter, white suburban voter, in a way that we haven't seen before. And so, you know, it's always tough to say what the Latino vote will do in a state like Arizona or across the Southwest or in places like Florida. It could end up helping him, but I also wouldn't bank on it.
Peter O'Dowd of NPR's Here and Now, he was joining us from rainy Philadelphia. Members of Arizona's delegation have been enthusiastic about the convention, and one of the delegates, Lawrence Robinson, joins me. Lawrence, how important has diversity been for Democrats, considering a lack of diversity at the Republican National Convention was mentioned by some observers?
It's not just racial diversity, which is, I think, the category that most folks point to first, but it's the fact that even in our delegation here with Arizona, we have a 102-year-old who couldn't even vote when she was born as a woman. We've got folks who represent every religious faith, many of which are under attack by the opposing party. But it also comes down to the fact that we are the party that represents the future of America. You look around at our convention and there's every stripe and every identity represented. And really, I think for the first time in American history, that's fully embraced by a national party. You know, 4 years ago, we didn't have gay marriage. 4 years ago, we didn't have a female nominee. And 4 years ago, you didn't see a really outward embracement of, let's say, Muslims or folks who might be on the far left, like the Bernie supporters. And so it really is a amalgamation of everything that is American. And I think everybody for the first time is actually welcome in an American National Party.
Let's talk a bit about Arizona's delegation. When this convention started, there was concern, and there have still been some feelings expressed by Bernie Sanders supporters that maybe he wasn't treated as well. Has there been anything in the Arizona delegation, and I don't mean in terms of great arguments or whatnot, but was there a split at all when the delegation arrived, and has that changed? Was there not a split? Describe that for me.
Well, one of the rare advantages our party has in Arizona as Democrats is we can't be disunited. I mean, if you're a Democrat in Arizona, you really understand that we're all in this together. And so I would say our party, our Democratic delegation from Arizona might be more united than almost any in the country. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, Democrats in Arizona are under attack. You know, we have issues that unify us. And so I think that whether you're a Bernie supporter or a Clinton supporter coming in, you realize once we go home, we're all in this together.
Lawrence, one thing that got a lot of attention when it came to the Republican convention was that Senators McCain and Flake, for different reasons, at least different reasons that they expressed publicly, did not attend the RNC. And Kirkpatrick, Representative Kirkpatrick and Representative Sinema have also not attended the DNC. Do you think that indicates anything negative, or is that just part of politics?
I think it's just part of politics. And you know, look, to be frank, Kyrsten Sinema represents a district that's right in the middle, you know, in terms of being blue and red. And I think that she's done a great job of that. And I think that optics matter. And so we know that she's with us on the issues that matter to Democrats. But there are also a lot of Republicans that know that she's pragmatic and middle of the road and represents them, too. And so why put, you know, yourself up into a muddled mess where you're going to have to answer to certain accusations when she's doing the job that the people elected her to? And I think Ann Kirkpatrick's just busy taking on an incumbent that's been there for a while, and she wants to make sure that she's focused on her job, which is winning in November.
One of Arizona's delegates to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Lawrence Robinson. Lawrence, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
For those people not at the DNC, they're still apparently searching for information about it. And Google's data editor, Simon Rogers, says those search topics have been changing over the course of the convention. He says on the first day, Bernie Sanders was among the more popular queries, but that started to change once Michelle Obama took the stage. And then on Tuesday, former President Bill Clinton spoke, and top searches including questions about the Clintons and their life.
One interesting thing that happened also is that for the first time that I can recall through the entire election, Hillary Clinton was more searched on Google in every single state than Donald Trump was.
Rogers says search topics can change quickly as convention speakers move from one topic to another. He says we've become a nation of second screens, one to watch and another to tweet, Facebook, and search.
I think people do have this amazing ability at the moment to, you know, see something on TV, and while that's going, they're listening to it, but then they're searching for something else. And that's something that's a real kind of cultural change for us. But we definitely see that. We see that as soon as somebody says something, there is an instant reaction.
Google reports immigration, ISIS, and abortion top the list of issues searched so far during the last day of the DNC.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
8 years ago, Hillary Clinton famously said her campaign for president put a lot of cracks in the proverbial glass ceiling. And tonight she'll become the first woman ever to accept a major party's nomination for president. It's a historic moment that's been a long time coming, according to Shirley Sandy Lance, president of the Arizona League of Women Voters. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with her about this today. And Lauren, the League of Women Voters was founded when women got the right to vote, right?
It was in 1920. That's 96 years ago. And Sandy Lance told me it was founded to inform voters about issues and get them involved in voting. They don't endorse candidates. They never have. But they do come together on issues they think are important. They hold forums. They hold debates. And, of course, they work to get women, especially young women, to think about running for office.
We have a program we run once a year in one high school called Running and Winning, where we have the high school choose the girls, usually junior, senior girls, and we bring in elected women from city, county, and legislative areas to talk with them about why they decided to run, how it affected them, what they did, because many high school girls have not ever talked to an elected official.
So I know your organization doesn't endorse any candidates, and you are nonpartisan.
No.
In light of what's happening right now in politics, in light of the speech that Hillary Clinton will give tonight to accept the Democratic Party's nomination for president, the first woman to ever do that for a major party, can you tell me a little bit about what you think about the historic nature of that?
Well, I think it's extremely historic and great that we have a woman who has been chosen to be a candidate from a major political party. And she holds many positions that the League has studied and holds. So we don't endorse her, but I think that it is a woman who has worked hard and had a passion about certain issues related to children and health, and has worked and moved in various first legal forms and then eventually a senator and a secretary of state. So we probably need to see more women do that. But I think it's wonderful. I'm sorry it's taken 96 years to have a woman in this position.
I was going to ask you about that. So 96 years women have had the right to vote. Did you think it would take 96 years?
You know, when I was younger, I really hoped that we would get a woman running. But I'm pragmatic and realize that to run in this, the way we do it in the United States, that it takes a lot of money. And I could see that there were not a lot of women who wanted to put themselves in the position of how difficult and hard it is to campaign.
How do you think we can work to get, and how does your organization work to get more women elected to higher offices?
I think you have to start young. You need to get students into county and city commissions or into working for candidates so that they see what the process is and see how decisions may have impact on them. You know, I think that young people often don't think there's impact, but actually all their laws governing their schools come out of the legislature. So somehow it has to come through education and information.
Well, Shirley Sandy Lins with the Arizona League of Women Voters, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me, Lauren.
We now know the two nominees, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. One of those people will be the next president of the United States.
But how much does that impact the rest of the world, and how much does the rest of the world care? The BBC's Rich Preston took a walk down London's Regent Street.
In America, there's been wall-to-wall coverage in newspapers, on the airwaves, and online for months. London is an international city, so it wasn't hard to find people who've been following American news.
I'm Raymond, I'm a stonemason from London. We're in central London, so we've got Oxford Street right behind me, Regent Street is just to the left.
52-year-old construction worker Raymond was wearing his high-vis jacket and hard hat. I asked him a simple question. How much do most people in the UK care about the American presidency?
They don't really.
He does, though. He travels to America. He has friends there. He's been watching things closely.
It's down to a two-horse race now. We've got Hillary Clinton and we've got the Trump.
Evelyn Warman and her friend Stuart Mitchell were on a break from the office in London's Soho district. They both work in advertising.
We actually watched it over the weekend and it seems almost like a beauty pageant. It's very gaudy, it's very showy. It is a bit of a joke, am I allowed to say that?
I thought it was kind of tacky, it was weird. Yeah. It was like a show, like there was all this music and people were dancing. It was so different to British politics.
But you said yourself, this is something that will affect the whole world.
Yeah, scary, right?
And she says that showmanship makes it hard to take seriously.
I feel a big disconnect to it, but at the same time, like you say, I know it will probably directly affect us in some way.
And at 6 o'clock, you're watching BBC One.
Hello, good morning. This is Breakfast with Charlie State and Louise Minchin.
Donald Trump accepts the Republican nominee.
Making history overnight, Hillary Clinton became the first female presidential nominee of a major US party.
Wednesday, 27th of July, 2016.
The campaigns have featured in mainstream British media. Those were the headlines when Trump and Clinton became their party's official nominees. But some people just don't care. 21-year-old Rachele Rossi moved to England from Italy 2 years ago.
So you must have heard of a man called Donald Trump?
No.
You've not heard of Donald Trump?
No.
She had no clue who Donald Trump is. And she says, why should she?
Why aren't you interested?
Because it's not my country.
Okay, I'm going to show you some newspaper front pages. There's Hillary Clinton, there's Donald Trump, the man I told you about. This means nothing to you.
No.
She says America's problems are for America to worry about. She'll focus on things closer to home.
I'm Diane Moffat, and this is my friend.
I'm Jackie Hodge.
Diane and Jackie live in Surrey, southwest of the capital. They were in the city for the day, meeting friends for lunch. They say, whether you like it or not, American politics is important outside of the US.
It's just a vital part, isn't it? I mean, what happens in America is going to affect what happens in the rest of the world.
The problem, they say, is that Americans themselves don't realise how important their politics are to the rest of the world.
You imagine Americans to be very bold and brash, but I think they're probably much more caring about their own lives than we are.
Diplomatic.
Well, I don't know.
Non-diplomatic.
Well, I don't know. They always strike me as a nation as being very parochial, you know, very sort of self-centred, but also have such a huge influence on what happens in the rest of the world.
How do you think most people in Britain feel about American politics?
I think some people are just switching off to it really here because we've heard so much about it.
One thing's for certain. People outside of the US can expect this story of foreign politics in some far-off land to remain high on their domestic news agenda for many months to come.
That's the BBC's Rich Preston in London. Grand Canyon National Park is trying to move past a scathing sexual misconduct report released in January by the Inspector General's office. In attempts to change the culture of harassment, the agency is investigating just how extensive complaints of sexual harassment have been at national parks, is setting up a confidential hotline, and for the first time is appointing a woman to oversee the park. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales spoke with officials at the Grand Canyon this week and has this report.
U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and three of the highest-level Park Service officials in the country step out of a black SUV at the rim of the Grand Canyon. They take in the iconic view for a few seconds before turning around to face a group of reporters who want to talk about the ugly events that took place on the river miles below. According to the Office of Inspector General, male River District employees preyed on their female coworkers for years, demanding sex and punishing those who refused.
That's unacceptable behavior. It is a failure of leadership. It's something that we have got to address. But I will say that this is a team of employees that wants to move on, that does not want to be defined by the actions of a few.
Jewel says she's just come out of a meeting with 300 of the park's staff. She told them how the department is responding to the sexual harassment report. Jewel called the victims' stories horrific. According to the OIG, higher-level officials allowed the hostile culture to fester. In the wake of the report, former Superintendent Dave Uberaga chose to retire after the agency offered him a job in Washington. Some say other leaders at the park should take the blame before him. But today, Park Service officials want to discuss how the agency will move forward.
Frankly, it's going to press a reset button on Grand Canyon National Park, where this is going to be one of the best places to work in the future.
Part of that reset is bringing in a new superintendent, Christine Lennertz.
Grand Canyon is a place that will lead the National Park Service through making sure our organization and this park are inclusive, respectful, and embrace diversity.
Lennertz is the first woman the park has had in this role. Regional Director Sue Massica hired her.
My focus was on what is the right set of skills that are needed at the Grand Canyon at this moment in time. Right place, right person, right time. And Chris is known as a collaborator. She's known as very caring and attentive to people. I needed a leader who would come in and set the tone in terms of moving forward, healing this park.
In her email to employees, Lennertz says her highest priority is and will always be employee safety. She says it's about setting expectations.
We will not tolerate things like sexism, sexual harassment, sexual assault, racism, all of those things. And the leader has to be very clear at the outset, so there's just no question in anyone's mind that there are rewards for those behaviors that are positive and consequences for those that are negative.
Lennertz worked for 16 years with the Environmental Protection Agency as a biologist before her first job in the National Park Service almost a decade ago. She served as deputy superintendent at Yellowstone, then regional director for the Pacific West, and for the last year, superintendent at Golden Gate National Recreation Area. She was the first woman to serve in all those roles with the Park Service. It's no coincidence the agency hired a woman now.
We know there are differences between genders. We can't pretend there aren't. I think the most important thing is that leadership has to be collaborative. And leadership doesn't come just from the superintendent. There's no model that works in our world that's hero-based. It's not about me coming in.
The Grand Canyon isn't the only national park dealing with sexual misconduct. The OIG is also investigating claims of sexual harassment at other national parks, like Cape Canaveral National Seashore. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
The World Health Organization says obesity rates have doubled worldwide since 1980, and that in 2014, more than 600 million adults around the globe were obese. But health officials may also be vastly underestimating the problem of obesity worldwide, and the current method of identifying it could be the problem. Dan Hrushka is an associate professor of global health and anthropology at ASU and has been working on this issue. And Dan, so obesity may actually be a bigger problem than we thought?
The frontline measure that's used by public health practitioners and doctors around the world, in the United States as well, to assess obesity and overweight is the body mass index, or BMI, which is simply a ratio of weight to height. It tells you really nothing about the body fat within a person. What human biologists have known for a very long time is that there's massive population variation in how much muscle mass different populations have or how slender they are. So you might compare, for example, I work in Bangladesh, and so many Bangladeshis are quite slender compared to, for example, Samoans, who generally have quite muscular frames on average. If you use this BMI measure across these different populations, it's confounding this muscle mass with fat mass, and it's very hard to determine whether this BMI is telling you about how much fat is inside someone's body.
And it seems like that would really be an indication of whether or not somebody's healthy, because two people could be the same height and the same weight, but on one person, some percentage of that weight could be muscle versus on another person, it could be body fat.
Right. So originally I got interested in this project because working in Bangladesh and in South Asia, I realized that even though people were quite slender as measured by BMI, there were very high rates of diabetes, which is a little bit of a puzzle.
So if not BMI, which several years ago was hailed as sort of a new, better way of measuring healthiness and obesity, what is a better way, do you think?
So researchers have proposed a number of different measures that might work better. So waist circumference, which is just putting a tape measure around someone's waist, the ratio of that to their height, or the ratio of that to their hips or their central body. These have all been proposed as alternative measures. I still think BMI is probably the most reliable and best vetted among all these measures, but we need better ways of interpreting it in different populations around the world.
Are you thinking of sort of like a cultural consideration for when you're looking and interpreting a BMI?
Right. So currently the WHO standard is 25. Anything greater than 25 would count as overweight, and anything greater than 30 would count as obese. And the WHO and a few countries like Japan, China, and India have toyed with changing that cutoff to lower levels in these parts of the world because these are naturally slender populations, which you wouldn't detect the body fat just using BMI cutoffs as developed by the WHO. But right now, we're still kind of groping around in the dark to figure out how much variation there is in Asia or within sub-Saharan Africa. So really more research is needed using the indirect measures my colleagues and I have been using, but also new techniques using X-ray to look at the real body composition of people in these different places.
Do you have a sense of how many obese people there are in the world that we have not counted?
Well, based on our estimates, because the WHO guidelines were created on European ancestry populations, which are generally quite stocky, a larger part of the world is actually slender compared to those European ancestry populations, meaning that using those standard cutoffs, we're missing many, many people. And our estimates suggest that it's at least 400 to 500 million people around the world.
That's a lot of people.
Currently. Yes. In places you might not expect, like Yemen and parts of Ethiopia and sub-Saharan Africa, as well as Nepal and India and China.
That especially seems like a big number because we keep hearing about how obesity is becoming this American and worldwide epidemic. To know that it may potentially be that much worse than we think it is a pretty big deal, it seems like.
Especially in low-income countries that don't necessarily have the health infrastructure to deal with the sequelae of high BMI, such as diabetes or cardiovascular disease. We're seeing this problem in Bangladesh right now, where you're starting to see very high rates of diabetes in places where you might not have the treatment for it.
Dan Hrushka is an associate professor of global health and anthropology at ASU. Dan, thank you.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Tori Weeks, and right now we are at The Yard in Phoenix, and we are just valeting cars that come in.
Hi, how are you?
We greet the guest, open the door.
Have a good time in there.
And then get in the car and park it. Sometimes it'll be cranked all the way up and you're listening to some Harry Potter book. I like how fast-paced it is.
91 and 92.
10, 15 people could come in at once and you have to know how to drive every car or else you're gonna hold up the whole line. Doing this job, I know how all of them drive and I know little parts about the insides of the cars that makes it really cool.
Thank you.
That's Tori Weeks driving cars for Integrity Valet. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to ride shotgun with us, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. A few years ago, federal court officials declared a judicial emergency in Arizona. There was such a backlog of cases because of a shortage of judges that trials had to be delayed for months. Some of those cases were related to illegal immigration. A new report by the group Grassroots Leadership called Indefensible, A Decade of Mass Incarceration of Migrants Prosecuted for Crossing the Border, studies in part what effect immigration policy has had on the court system over the past decade. Bethany Carson is an immigration policy researcher and organizer with Grassroots Leadership and joins me to talk about the report. Bethany, what happens when an undocumented person is caught coming into the U.S.? What are they charged with?
The first place they will end up is what's known as the Yalera or ice box, which are Border Patrol holding facilities, which are extremely cold. People aren't given proper medical care or food. And then if they are marked for criminal prosecution, they will either be taken straight to the court or go to a U.S. Marshals facility and be held there for a couple of days. And then they'll be prosecuted in a federal court, and there can be, if they're going through the official Operation Streamline track, that means that there are these mass court proceedings where up to 80 shackled migrants are arraigned, convicted, and sentenced for a misdemeanor improper entry charge or a felony charge that they then plead down to a misdemeanor and then taken to typically another U.S. Marshals facility or sent back to the same one to serve out their sentence. And then they're kicked back to the civil immigrant detention system, typically for rapid deportation.
Are the charges harsher if they're caught multiple times?
Yes, because what typically happens, you know, at least at the Texas border, is that they are originally prosecuted for an improper entry charge, which is only a misdemeanor, and then the second time they can be prosecuted for the felony. And also in Arizona, you know, typically a first time, that'll plea down to a misdemeanor, but then once they're caught multiple times, there's an increasing chance that, you know, somebody will be prosecuted for the felony or at least given more time because there are judges who, you know, think that that will serve as a deterrent to them coming back across the border.
How many migrants are currently being processed in the U.S. federal court system for being undocumented, for crossing into the country illegally?
In 2015, almost 70,000 migrants were prosecuted for either improper entry or reentry. And this is a program that's existed for the past 10 years. So since 2005, nearly 750,000 people have been prosecuted in our federal courts.
Operation Streamline, has it not lived up to what it was supposed to do, or is it really fit what it was supposed to do, and it's just not potentially especially effective?
What we found through our investigation is that Operation Streamline and the associated felony prosecutions are completely ineffective and really a failed policy by every measure. Operation Streamline began in 2005 in Del Rio, and it was, you know, according to the Border Patrol, it was a policy that was created to try to deter migration. But what we found through all of our interviews with federal defenders and judges and the migrants themselves is that the reasons why people are coming across are so strong that, you know, that deterrent to migration has not shown to be effective because people are coming to reunite with their families. They're coming for economic opportunity for themselves and to support their families, either in the U.S. or back home. And then also people are coming fleeing violence and seeking asylum.
What kind of changes to the system would you like to see? Are those changes ones that you think could be bipartisan and could happen in the near future?
What we're recommending is that these prosecutions be deprioritized. So that is something that is very possible and a very reasonable policy ask. So that actually is not the same as decriminalization, although we believe that that should also happen, but it's not politically viable in this current political environment with the Congress. And so what can happen is the Department of Justice can do exactly what they did with a lot of the Smart on Crime reforms that decrease the priority level of drug crimes as a way to begin to rectify a lot of the harms that were done in these inflated sentences that were given for drug crimes. And so we believe that deprioritization is possible, and it's a really smart policy.
Bethany Carson is an immigration policy researcher and organizer with Grassroots Leadership. We've been talking about the group's new report called Indefensible, a decade of mass incarceration of migrants prosecuted for crossing the border.
You could say the aerospace industry has taken off in Arizona. In fact, you could say it's soaring. A new study by PricewaterhouseCoopers puts Arizona at number one in the U.S. for aerospace manufacturing attractiveness. Basically, the state looks good to aerospace and defense companies like Able Aerospace in Mesa.
There were three employees when I bought the company back in 93. We have well over 500 now.
That's CEO Lee Benson. He says the company started by working on individual parts, but after opening a new maintenance center this month, it now works on entire helicopters.
And now that we're working on entire aircraft, we could be as high as 800 to 900 employees organically over the next 4 or 5 years.
Benson says they've always been in Arizona, but there was a time he considered leaving.
About, 6 years ago, I went to the city of Mesa and I said, what can you do for us to stay in the state? Because other states were heavily recruiting us to leave. And at the time, Mayor Smith said, we'll work with you. And they actually built us a facility here where they used their cash, tax-exempt bonds to build it, and we're fully paying it all back through the lease payment with the airport and the city of Mesa.
Benson's glad he stayed, and he points to the low cost of living and availability of qualified employees as a couple of reasons why he did. The PricewaterhouseCoopers survey gives Arizona high marks for its tax structure and operating expenses relative to other states. And aerospace is one of the industries state officials have been trying to expand in Arizona. Sandra Watson is the president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority, which is a big part of that effort. And Sandra, what do you make of the PwC ranking?
Well, we're thrilled that PwC has ranked Arizona number one across the country for aerospace and defense. Obviously, we've been growing this industry for a number of years in Arizona, and it's nice to be recognized as a leader in aerospace and defense.
To what do you attribute Arizona's ranking?
Well, I attribute our ranking to a number of things. Obviously, we have a very focused governor who is leading the charge to improve our business climate. What has happened in Arizona over the years, as you know, we have begun, or the aerospace and defense industry began years ago here in Arizona. So back in the early 50s, Honeywell Aerospace, as well as Raytheon Missiles, began to grow their operations here. With those two anchors, Arizona began to grow its industry with aerospace and defense. Over the years, we've seen significant growth with a number of other industry leaders. In addition to having these anchored aerospace and defense companies here in Arizona, we've grown a significant supply chain to support those industries. One significant thing that I'd like to point out is that these industries began their operations in the 50s and have continued to grow. So Arizona's comprehensive economic development strategy is not just about attracting new companies. It's really focused on how do we help existing industries in our state continue to grow.
What do you think ultimately is the potential for this industry in Arizona relative to all of the other types of companies and jobs that leaders are trying to bring to the state?
Well, this industry produces quality jobs. It will continue to grow. Arizona has seen just in the last 3 years a 22% growth in our exports from just aerospace and defense. So it contributes greatly to our economy. We'll continue to see growth opportunities in Arizona because the employees that are needed for this industry are coming from our higher ed community. So we envision, obviously, with this competitive nature globally, that Arizona will continue to grow its operations in aerospace and defense.
The PwC report, it seems to me, is kind of like a potential kind of thing because it measures attractiveness, not so much the number of jobs or the output of a particular industry, in this case, aerospace. So given that Arizona is ranked as the most attractive place for these companies to land, and as you referenced the state's history with aerospace, is there a danger of Arizona not fulfilling that potential and maybe not taking advantage of this relative attractiveness that it has right now for these particular kinds of firms?
I believe when PwC identified Arizona as the most attractive place for aerospace and defense, it looked at a number of areas. So when we talk about the concentration of our employee base, so the human capital required for aerospace and defense, companies cannot be successful unless they've got the right employees in place. So the fact that Arizona has created a solid foundation from a tax policy standpoint, from a regulatory environment standpoint, from a talent-based standpoint, in addition, the quality of life here in Arizona is far superior than it is in other places. We believe that that combination will continue to allow us to grow in this industry. The other advantage that Arizona has is our focus on innovation. And so having this incredible supply chain and supply base full of early stage small businesses that are really focused on innovation and advancing the industry, coupled with the fact that we've got these icon established leaders, I think is a great recipe for success.
Sandra Watson is the president and CEO of the Arizona Commerce Authority. Sandra, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Phoenix's above-average high temperatures are expected to continue for at least another day or so, with highs forecast for around 112 and 113 through tomorrow. That'll be before it cools all the way down to about 105.
And to add insult to weather-related injury, Phoenix could be on its way to having the most 110-plus degree days in history. Joining me with more on this is Bob Henson. He's a blogger and meteorologist at Weather Underground. And Bob, will Phoenix actually break this dubious record?
Well, Phoenix is on track for potentially breaking the record for the most number of 110-degree days in 1 year, but it's not a slam dunk yet. We were up to 25 such days as of Wednesday, and it looks like by the end of this week we will be up to 27. Now, we have had more than that. In 2011, there were a total of 33 days, and in 2007 there were 32. So this is putting up in the upper echelon, but it's going to depend on August whether or not the record actually gets broken.
This is a record I think that most Phoenicians would be perfectly happy not setting. What is going on that is causing these high temperatures and as many 110-plus degree days as we've had so far?
Well, it's been certainly a hot year, not just locally, not just nationally, but globally. It's on track to be the warmest year on record for the planet as a whole, the third consecutive year that we'll break that record. In the United States, we've had the warmest spring on record. And certainly in the Phoenix area, it's been a very warm year. So far, January through June was the second warmest year. So there's been a lot of lead up to this summer. And certainly June got things off to an extremely hot start. You had the highest temperatures you've ever seen before the summer solstice. So that said, the temperatures in late summer depend a little bit more on the monsoon and whether it materializes as expected or not and how strong it is. So that adds a little bit of uncertainty what's going to happen in August. But certainly the dryness of the winter, spring into summer, the unusual lack of moisture, the fact that El Nino didn't really come through as expected and drench Arizona and Southern California probably paved the way to some extent for the hot summer you're having.
As you mentioned, it's not just Phoenix and Arizona that have been having a hot summer. Can you explain for us what this concept of a heat dome is and why it's causing higher than normal temperatures in all these different places?
Well, sure. I think the term heat dome has gained some currency this summer because it's a pithy term, and in fact, one that a lot of people haven't heard before, so it's gained some currency. But in fact, meteorologists have used heat dome for many years, and it's kind of a term of art. It's not ever been strictly defined. It's really just talking about a dome of high pressure. And what happens is, as air heats up, it expands. So if you look at the surface of contours of air pressure, then what looks like a dome shows up on charts when you go up a few miles above ground level. And usually there's a big H planted on it on a weather map. Often on TV you'll see surface maps showing highs and lows, but we're talking here in terms of the heat dome about high pressure extending all the way up through the atmosphere, again produced by just heat not only at the surface but through the lowest several miles of the atmosphere.
Does the fact that this summer has been so hot tell us anything about what to expect for the fall or for this coming winter?
Well, it's really hard to extrapolate from summer to fall, and this is especially true when we're in a transition mode as we are now. We're going from what was a very, very strong El Nino, actually the strongest on record by some measures, into what looks like is going to be a La Nina, and perhaps just a weak one, but we're already on the borderline of entering La Nina. So that will probably not affect Arizona's climate a huge amount, but the fact that La Nina doesn't have a huge influence means the region will be prone to other forces that might produce ups and downs in weather and climate. So it's a little hard to say right now how the rest of the year is going to unfold, and even really August will depend a lot on just how strong the monsoon is. It hasn't been particularly strong this year. I'd say there's about a 50-50 chance that you'll have the most 110 days for a given year. In recent years, you've tended to have about 6 days of 110-degree weather in August. It used to be that would almost never happen in Phoenix, but now you get about six on average. So if you add that to what we've seen so far, it'll be probably in the low 30s.
Bob Henson is a blogger and meteorologist at Weather Underground. Bob, thanks.
Thank you so much.
If Arizona State University's Tempe campus were an open book, Palm Walk would be the binding. It's a north-to-south walkway right through the middle of campus that's been there for about 100 years.
And yes, the same trees planted there originally stand there now, but the university decided those trees have passed their prime. The show's Annika Klein was there for the planting of some new palms.
On the south end of Palm Walk, a crew has already removed 35 Mexican fan palms and is replacing them with date palms.
A lot of our students are saying, we need shade on this campus.
That's ASU landscape architect Byron Sampson.
They loathe going through this campus in the summer or the hot months because there's no shade.
Palm Walk might be convenient, but the 110 fan palms standing from 50 to 70 feet tall provide almost zero shade. Sampson says the shorter, leafier date palms are expected to provide dappled shade over the whole walkway.
The Mexican fan palms really did that great job of creating that strong sense of oasis and character, and now we're just taking that the next level.
And not just with shade. The trees will also produce dates for the annual campus harvest. They plan to replace all the palms by 2018. It's costing the school about $500,000 to put in the first 35 new trees. But if the old palms could talk, they would have a lot to tell us about their past 100 years at ASU. Since they can't, university archivist Rob Spindler does the talking.
So what we're looking at here is a rather large leather-bound account book.
Spindler looked through old handwritten ledgers to try to piece together the backstory of Palm Walk.
$38.45 for trees in March 1917.
Another $200 for trees that same year. University President Arthur John Matthews was notorious for his love of gardening. But the first reference to palm trees is in 1918.
$7 for palm trees from Blasingame Nurseries.
He places the planting of Palm Walk somewhere between 1916 to 1920. But back then it was called Normal Street. It was an actual city street.
There was a time when it ran all the way from University Drive to Apache Boulevard.
Just a few feet high, the new palms were witness to a student lifestyle that students today might balk at.
During the hot summer months, individuals would actually sleep outside in these screened-in porches.
They were called sleeping porches.
And they would wet their sheets in order to stay cool during the hot summer nights.
The original seven or eight buildings on campus eventually became many, all with air conditioning. The palms grew taller as Tempe Normal School became Arizona State College and finally Arizona State University.
March on, Arizona, with your banners waving high.
They saw the school mascot change from the bulldog to the sun devil, and throughout the years, the palms appear as a poster child for the campus.
When you look at the college catalogs, you'll see references to the college palms in 1926.
A 1967 campus map makes the first reference to the name Palm Walk. Spindler says it had become an icon and one of the most photographed places on campus. And he says that's something that should be preserved.
Having historic places that look the same, that remind our alumni of what it was like to go here whenever they were here in the 60s, the 70s, the 1990s, is really important.
So the new trees, just 18 feet tall, have quite a legacy to uphold over the next 100 years. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.